Welcome to Off the Bench with Danny Cannell.
Back to throw, first and 10, the pass is deep to his tight end.
And Rajah Bell.
Bell has done three things. 22 for Rajah.
Saw the future of football right before your eyes. Just yell it out, man. He can't guard me.
All right, what's going on? Welcome to Cannell and Bell, hanging out here with Brady Quinn is in for Rajah. Rajah will be back next week, I promise. A lot of people were like, well, where? I thought he was going to be back on Thursday. No, next week.
Next week.
A little extra load management, just a couple more days to rest, relax up.
that's what we're calling it.
Yeah, it's load management.
He is getting old.
Yeah, exactly. He is getting up there. So we got Brady in for that, so we're going to get to a bunch of NFL stuff. I want to get Brady's thoughts on the rule changes. We're going to do a lot of the NCAA tournament recap, and we're going to have some fun. We'll have a good time today. Do you are your kids going to be into gymnastics?
Yes.
Probably. Because people don't know your wife is.
Probably. My wife was in the 2008 Olympics.
Yep.
For gymnastics, obviously. Yep. And she coaches now. So she used to take my oldest daughter with her. And I think it piqued her interest in it because of that. But at this point in time, she's still probably too young to really know.
I'm just giving you a warning because I did this thing the other day and I think gymnastics might be up there. And it's not a knock on gymnastics. But some of the toughest youth sports to watch.
Oh, yeah.
I had soccer in there. So I put track at the top of the list, swimming as second, and I had soccer, but I think I might throw in gymnastics in there. It's just the nature of some of these events, like that. Anytime you hear the term meet.
Right.
Like that means all day affair and you're only actually performing for a very limited window of time. So you're sitting around so much. My daughter has a swim meet. It's like an hour and a half away. So we're going there and I am dreading it because I know I'm going to have to drop her off at 7:30 a.m. Saturday. She will not get done probably till 8 p.m. at night and I will be there like stuck, like reading books, going on the computer, like doing all this stuff. So it's going to be a long weekend for me.
I'm concerned about it. That's why we're trying to get her into golf. I feel like even though it's long, you and I have talked about
this,
you know, you get to be with them, but also you don't golf in crappy places. Like
right.
You're going to golf. It's going to be nice weather outside, or at least decent weather. It's not like you're going to be in a frozen tundra. So for that reason, we're trying to get her into golf.
Yep.
We'll see.
When you got injured, did you downplay your injuries or did you play them up to get a little extra sympathy?
No, I was more of downplaying them.
I think I was too. We have a guy here on our show in Matthew Coca.
Yeah.
Who is our producer. We've talked a lot about his injury because he's playing through the pain right now. Yeah. But I'm starting to feel like he's milking it a little bit for some extra sympathy. Yeah, you saw him with the ice pack in the office.
There was an ice pack in the office.
How many people actually bring an ice pack into the office? Like, we get you're hurting now, but that's like, you can do that at your lunch break. Look, he's so mad right now. That's our wonderful producer there,
Matt. Still have the ice pack? Is it still in your bag?
It is. It is there.
Ignoring you guys
he's refusing to talk to us now.
I was going to say, not all heroes wear capes.
He's kind of our Ben Roethlisberger. Because he's a Hall of Fame producer, but he loves talking about his injuries and loves letting you hear about it. So that's our guy. But he's not selfish, and he doesn't have 52 kids around him. He has grown men around him. All right, let's do some actual sports. Let's get this thing rolling. Florida State was in action last night. I hated this matchup from the perspective of I don't watch a ton of college basketball throughout the season, but I obviously was cheering for Florida State. But one of the things I try to watch are the trends, where the public money is going and where the sharp money is going. And everybody was throwing money at Florida State saying, man, this team is athletic. They're hot. They're on fire. And that the spread was just too tempting. It was a 7.5-point spread. And everybody's like, oh, Florida State's easily going to cover that. I didn't love that. And that was one of the reasons I thought Gonzaga would win and cover. And that's exactly what happened. But the thing I was bummed about from a Florida State, you know, alum perspective, is that Florida State had two of their better players out, and then on top of that, they shot the ball awful. Like, it was the worst time to have one of your worst shooting performances of the year. And then I found myself really not liking Gonzaga. They look like they have some punks, just from a personal standpoint. Maybe that's because I was bothered because Florida State was getting waxed.
Well, and didn't Florida State knock them out last year? So this is a little bit of a revenge to this. I mean,
totally.
It's not like both these teams have a bunch of one and done. So there's probably that element to it. I think they felt like they had something to prove. To be honest with you, though, as my mother-in-law calls them, Gorgonzola, I do think they have something to prove. Like, they're a number one seed. This is a team that has been in the tournament now. They're a brand name, if you will, in college basketball, and they haven't been able to do it. I mean, I looked at them in my bracket this year, and I said, yeah, I'm probably going to pick them to get to the Final Four. I'm not going to pick them to win it.
Yep.
They might be the best team in the tournament, in my opinion, next to Duke. Maybe UNC falls in that category. I think those three teams are probably – they've separated themselves this season coming into the tournament, in my mind. And I think Gonzaga, I almost called him Gorgonzola. they did nothing else to change that opinion now, but I do think they need to win one. Like, this is to the point now where, you know, we get it. You're not that small little school anymore, small little Jesuit school. Now it's time that you step up and you actually win a championship.
I kind of feel like they're being overlooked. And I think Carolina is to some extent too, North Carolina, right, because there's been so much attention played to Duke with, you know, Zion there and the Zion hype, which has all been great. And it's been great for college basketball. But, and Duke's the heavy favorite to win the tournament, to win it all. Not heavy, but they are the Vegas favorite to win the tournament. And I kind of feel like we're sleeping on North Carolina, Gonzaga, some of these other ones. Virginia, I'm still a little bit skeptical of. So that was the game that was ugly, but I wanted to leave with that because it was Florida State, and I gave out Gonzaga -7.5. So hopefully you won some money on that. But the game of the night was clearly Purdue versus Tennessee, because I didn't watch the first half because I was thinking, hey, Purdue's going to blow them out. Like, they're going to take them. Actually had money.
You thought Purdue was going to blow them out?
Well, no, I was watching the Florida State game and the score bug was up there and it was 10, 15. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, that game's done. Like, I don't even have to flip back to that one. As soon as Florida State was finished, then I flipped over and started watching the Purdue-Tennessee game, which was perfect because that's when it started getting good. And when I say getting good, it was insane. Of course, it was a controversial finish, but the way those teams were trading threes
back and forth
late in the fourth quarter, it was one of the most entertaining basketball games, period, that I've seen in a long time.
It was the best in the tournament by far.
Yeah.
Now, look, a lot of controversy with the way it finished. I will go back and look at the play, and should have been a foul, should have not have been a foul. We were talking about this before the show. My whole thing is, if you're the defender and you're in that position where, I get it, he's shooting a three, you have to contest it because that's for the win. But you also have to be cognizant that if you make contact, there's a strong likelihood they're going to call a foul. And I know it was ticky-tack, didn't feel like it was much. It impacts. It's different than if you're driving to the hoop. And then obviously the finish of the game, a little bit controversial with them trying to inbound the ball.
That was just dumb. It wasn't controversial.
Some people who are part of this show.
Yeah. Again, our boy Debo's in there fighting for Rick Barnes, apparently.
Well, no, I don't think Debo so much. Matt Coca, once again, our producer.
Yeah.
Who's fighting through an injury. He's the one that he actually liked the play. I didn't. I said if I was a player and I was in that position, I would rather have 1.7 seconds. You inbound the ball, let me take a dribble, and then maybe a half-court shot, and it would be probably a cleaner look than having such a small amount of time and such a small like window for success in that scenario. So I think
I'm with you. Plus, you can't advance it, obviously, in college basketball with a timeout. But you know what you can do to advance it that doesn't, you know, have time on the clock? When you throw a half-court pass. Like a la the Duke play with Christian Laettner when they beat Kentucky. They threw it all the way down to him. He had a time to make a little move and flip it around. Now, obviously, that was one of the all-time epic plays in college basketball. And can you replicate that? Probably not. But I'd rather even catch the ball at half-court, take a dribble, and get closer to where you're like a 35-foot three-pointer than what happened to them where they get the out-of-bounds play with .1 and they have to like flip it backwards over their head. It just didn't seem like it made a lot of sense. And Rick Barnes was getting crushed for it. And I thought deservedly so.
Right. And I also think there's the chance that when you see a ticky-tack foul on the other end, maybe there's a chance too that with that 1.7, you can draw a little extra contact. Because when you're a player in that scenario, you have a little bit more time. So you can try to work yourself into the defender, then take the shot, and maybe they call a foul, maybe not. With what would have been 0.6 maybe, 0.7, 0.5, depending on how you look at when the clock should have stopped, when the officials recognize the timeout, you don't have any time. Your only thought is, I have to get the shot off, and you're hoping that you can get turned around quick enough to see the rim and take a shot to hit it. So that was the only thing I really didn't like down the stretch. It was an unbelievable finish to regulation. Unfortunately, though, overtime just kind of got away from Tennessee.
It was insane. I thought it was a bad call, the foul call, but I understand why he called it. Like in a bang-bang type situation, he went up there. It looked like there could have been even a little bit of contact on the hand, but it looked like the body, the way he like had to move, it looked like he bumped him a little bit. I totally understand a Tennessee fan that's ticked off today. That's like, hey, we got robbed. I totally understand it, but it comes down to one of those ones, and basketball is probably the hardest sport to say this. Like, if you're the better team, which Tennessee was, you don't let it come down to that. Now, they had the lead, obviously, you know, but you closed them out earlier. But I totally get the Tennessee, you know, being ticked off about it. I have a new favorite player in the tournament, though. And it's not, Carson Edwards is awesome to watch for Purdue, but my man Ryan Klein was on fire from three. I mean, some of the shots he was hitting, like
deep,
these step backs and like just catching it, not even really seeing it, fading away and hitting these threes from all over the place. It was incredible. And for him to do it on that stage was just like, I thought that was a monster moment for him.
I'd be curious to see if they can keep that going though.
Right.
You and I know how this goes, especially anyone who's played basketball. You live by the shot,
yep.
Die by the shot, especially in this tournament. If you're going to rely on hot shooting or streaky shooting to get you through to win a championship, I just don't think that works. I think you see that the taller, more athletic teams, those that are able to figure out ways of getting to the free throw line, getting rebounds, playing good defense,
yep.
Those tend to be the teams that can survive through a bad shooting night.
Totally. And I think what you hit on right there, better defense too. I think defense always, you know, if you're off shooting the ball, defense translates because you can get the ball back. And that clearly, Florida State, one of the reasons people love them so much was because they dominated Ja Morant and Murray State.
They were
on fire in that game. They followed it up, of course, going 3 from 20, from the 3-point line last night. So not exactly the way to follow it up. I always feel really awful for teams that lose the way Tennessee does, the Saints in the NFC Championship game, like when you get robbed like that, or you have a heartbreaking, you know, chance where you miss a last shot. Do you have a loss of yours that like is still hard to get over?
Oh, this perfectly ties into something that just changed in the NFL. So we just changed the replay rule,
yep.
Right? So now we're going to be able to look at via a challenge if it's outside of the last 2 minutes in each half. We'll be able to look at offensive and defensive pass interference. And then in the final 2 minutes, we're going to have a replay assistant now be able to look at and see whether or not there is defensive pass interference or offensive pass interference on any of the 5 eligible players in the field. 2009, we're in Detroit. Best game of my career. I think I threw like 3 touchdown passes in 1 quarter. Should have had a 5th. We had a running back drop a wheel route, literally right in the bread basket, drop through, settle for a field goal on that drive. But it ends up being kind of a shootout in this game. So final seconds of the game. As you would expect, Detroit throws up a Hail Mary to Calvin Johnson. He gets called for pass interference, which, look, it was definitely pass interference, but you could always make that case on a Hail Mary on someone. There's a lot of grabbing and tugging, pushing and shoving going both ways. Well, now this becomes a reviewable play, right? And so it immediately brought me back to this is a bad scenario for the NFL because you're probably going to see teams take a couple opportunities now at Hail Marys because there's going to be some sort of pass interference called at some point if you're going to put this on this guy in a booth that no one can see out there in the field, this replay official. So it immediately took me back to that game because they called the pass interference. They got an untimed down from the 1 yard line. They scored a touchdown on that next play. And then instead of kicking the PAT, which this is back before they moved it back,
yep.
They're playing at home, they go for 2, they get the 2-point conversion, game over, we lose.
Right.
We're up by a touchdown, we're up by 7 points. So it was one of those scarring things ever, but because of the new change, now allowing replay to be reviewed for defensive pass interference, offensive pass interference, it brought me right back to that moment. I was thinking, other quarterbacks are going to have to go through this at some point.
Right? Oh, totally. They're absolutely going to have to go for it. And that, the thing I was talking about, like Tennessee losing, I feel like the losses stick with you way more than the victories. Like I had a high school state basketball championship my sophomore year. We lost by 1 point. I didn't even take the last shot. It was a buddy of mine, but he got fouled on the way up. They didn't call it, but he still missed kind of an easy shot. And like, it's still one. Like I get together with my buddies from high school 20 years later and we're like, oh, I can't believe we lost that game. It's just the way it works. All that being said, with the replay review, are you okay with it? Like, if you're in there voting, if you're on the competition committee, would you have voted yes, let's do this, or no, let's keep it the same?
I would have tweaked one thing. I would have allowed the coaches to be able to challenge at any point in time in the game. I don't understand why they're then restricting their ability to do it in the final 2 minutes, only because if we want to put it on the officials to get it right, because that was what supposedly was the issue with last year in the NFC Championship game, because they missed not only the pass interference, but also a personal foul.
Right.
Why are we then leaving it on another official to then get it right? And I think how he's going to handle it, being able to, in a hurry-up scenario at the end of the game, because right in the final 2 minutes, there's going to be a team coming back from it. How do you handle then trying to view all 5 eligible receivers and seeing whether or not there was defensive pass interference or offensive pass interference in that time frame where they're rushing up to the ball to get another play? It's either they're going to have to slow down the pace of play, they're going to have to buzz down, throw a flag, however they're going to, you know, go through the operations of it. Or they're not going to be able to catch everything.
Right.
And so that's why I feel like if you gave coaches the ability to challenge in the final 2 minutes, they're throwing the red flag, they're stopping the play, and now they have a chance to go review it, and especially if they have timeouts for that. So that's the only part of it I really didn't understand. I don't know why they just didn't allow the coaches it to extend into those final 2 minutes too.
I don't like it. I probably would have voted against it, and here's why. Like, that call was an egregiously bad miscall. Like, right. They should have thrown the flag. They obviously didn't. I don't think those happen that much. You know, like, and that was one where it did cost them a lot. I would have said, if I was the NFL, or if I was any of these people, like, I would have said, you know what? Let's just wait a little. Let's wait 1 year. Let's just breathe. Because it's such the hot topic. In Atlanta at the Super Bowl, it dominated almost every interview. Yeah. Everybody was like, oh my gosh, what should this do? It's dominated the offseason. I feel like it was such a reactionary move that if the NFL would have just let the regular season get here, take one season, just let it breathe, people probably would have forgotten about it. Now, Saints fans obviously wouldn't have. And then you wouldn't have had to make this drastic of a change. You know what I think would have worked too? Is if you would have had like the sky jugs, like the AAF is using, where you can buzz down if there isn't a grease. But here's the thing. I think the NFL has an ego.
100%.
I don't think they would absolutely, they do not want to take something that the AAF started and then say, hey, that looks good. Let us use it because they're the NFL. They don't want to take that.
Speaking of Dean Blandino about this, who was the former VP of officiating, and he admitted just that. He said they will never outwardly admit it, but even the 4th and 15, proposal that John Elway made instead of the onside kick, only because what, like two teams I think recovered onside kicks last year, and the way they've changed the alignment for kickoffs has made it really difficult for you know the team that's kicking to be able to then recover it. So he goes up with his 4th and 15 proposal, and it's very similar to what the AAF did with the 4th and 12 for the same scenario. Yep. And of course they shoot it right down. So there is some element of ego, and I think also that we're the NFL, and we don't do things the way everyone else does. We do them when we want to and for our reasons. I think we need to implement replay, though, in a way that does enhance the game, because we're getting to a point where other sports are doing it. They're doing it more successfully. I'm surprised that they didn't implement it for personal fouls and for player safety.
Yeah.
Because you could have made that call on that play in the NFC Championship game, and it would have solved everything.
Yep.
Even though it would have been a missed, pass interference, it still would have been a personal foul, automatic first down. Saints would have most likely won in that case.
But to the same point as AAF, do you know who used replay? College football.
Yeah.
They look at
same thing.
So they don't want to take it from college football because they're in the NFL. It drives me nuts.
Like they need to take a page out of the Major League Baseball though, and say we're going to do this just for the preseason.
Yep.
And then we'll talk about the next year. So for example, like instead of implementing it now, just say we're going to look at it for the five preseason games because of the Hall of Fame game, and then obviously the four others for all the other teams. We're going to see how it goes and then see how the operations are. If it's smooth, we'll look at putting it in 2020. But right now, we don't want to make any permanent changes. Now, it is only in for a year.
Yep.
But it's
very
significant
rarely
because
are they going to go change it back.
Because they have to get 24 votes against it now.
Yeah.
They
are, it was 31-1.
31-1.
I couldn't believe there was more pushback than that. I find it hard to believe that not more than, it was only the Bengals, that they were the only team that said, hey, wait a second, maybe this isn't the best idea. I was just shocked that it was that, the majority of the teams that said okay.
I think why you saw that is because you did have a 32-0 vote by the coaches.
Right.
And the coaches obviously have the ear of their owners. And I think it's a good thing. I think it's a good thing that the coaches were behind this. This is what they want. And they are trying to take steps at making the game better so this doesn't ever happen again. Because regardless of whether you're Sean Payton or anyone else, maybe except for Sean McVay, although Sean McVay should be thinking this, at some point you have to be thinking, it's going to impact me.
Yep.
There's going to be a missed call that we're upset about. We send them to the league and then they're frustrated with us. So I think they were all on board for it, and because of that, they're probably more able to persuade the owners to feel that way too.
Do you know you were wrong on your stats in that game versus the Detroit Lions?
Ooh.
You said you had 3 touchdowns. You had 4. See, I would have gone the other way. I would have said 5, and then you would have corrected me and said no 4. You had 4 touchdowns, 21-33 for 304 yards, 4 touchdowns, 0 interceptions. That's pretty strong. You were right on that one. So good stuff out of you.
Didn't get much better than that in my career.
That's awesome.
New CBS Monday.
Federal agents!
Hands where we can see them!
NCIS Hawaii is back.
About to set it all on fire!
New criminals to catch.
Armed robbery, aggravated assault, murder.
And new investigations to be solved.
These guys were good, but even masters make mistakes.
Vanessa Lachey and featuring LL Cool J.
Violin Island, you got it.
Welcome to paradise.
A new NCIS Hawaii, Monday, 10, 9 central on CBS and streaming on Paramount+.
The hit Paramount Plus original docuseries returns.
The last time I saw Max, he looked at us laughing, and then everything changed in a blink of an eye.
My feeling as a detective is that he was murdered.
Yahoo Entertainment calls it a spine-chilling docuseries showcasing real-life tragedies.
What about when your child who went missing?
We need to know the truth.
Never seen again. Now streaming on Paramount Plus.
All right, welcome back. Canelle and Bell hanging out with Brady Quinn. I feel like I'm always with you. I'm like, man, I should have dressed a little bit nicer. Today, I definitely should have shaved off the Fu Manchu.
I like it.
You're just saying that. You totally
No, because you have the whole look going on.
Yeah, it
right
is
now.
Definitely a look, but it's not Halloween.
I think it's cool to be...
Because it does look a little clownish.
Yeah, but like, okay, we live in South Florida.
Yep.
There's not really a whole lot of change in seasons.
Exactly.
But you can change the look up. So it's kind of like it's like being able to walk in like, oh, Danny looks different today. He's got a little Fu Manchu,
right?
He looks
it's definitely different.
Like he could have been Sylvester Stallone and over the top. We talked about this yesterday.
Right. Yeah, I do. You go that the move and then you got to go for the move, the over the top.
Yeah.
You actually work the
which
hand.
Which is 100% up. Illegal, isn't it?
I think it is. Yeah. Cause it seems like you would totally just use all your weight. You asked me before the show if my wife liked it. No, she hates it. You asked me if my kids liked it and yeah. I wanted to save the answer for you because this morning I typically take my kids to school. Like I'll drop them off on the way to work. Today I was like, you guys want me to take you to school? And they were like, nope. They were like terrified. They did not want any of their friends to see me with the Fu Manchu. So that's your answer right there. They hate it. So it'll be gone. It's just a one day thing, kind of to mix things up. All right, back to football because the NFL draft is just around the corner. We're getting closer and closer. A majority of the conversation, it's funny how this works is, and I think it's kind of laziness on a lot of part of networks, channels, you get kind of on this one conversation. But it has been this conversation as dominant as what are the Arizona Cardinals going to do with the number one overall pick? Vegas has Kyler Murray as -850, which is essentially saying he is a lock to go number one. Now, of course, the Cardinals could train out of that. He could still go to number one. What do you think the Cardinals should do with their number one pick?
It's hard to answer that question because I don't know if there's a potential team that's looking at trading up to number one to take Kyler Murray.
Right.
And if you think about the Arizona Cardinals, they've really got to keep their cards close to their vest because up until they are put in that situation where they're on the clock, they don't know what someone's ultimately going to trade, you know, for Kyler Murray for. Mm-hmm. They don't know what someone's going to trade for Josh Rosen for. Because I think the problem with if you draft Kyler Murray number one, your ability to trade Josh Rosen goes down as far as what you can get in return for the compensation. So they've got to be careful about how they go about doing this if they ultimately are targeting Kyler Murray because they've got to get a deal done for Rosen before then they you know show their cards and
right.
turn them all over. So my whole thing with Vegas is Vegas. Do they have some inside intel? Maybe, but they've been wrong before. Okay, so I get there's a lot of thought into why it would make sense, and I do think it makes sense. If you want to go all in on Cliff Kingsbury and what he can potentially bring, then you draft Kyler Murray because he would probably be the best fit in his system. That doesn't mean Josh Rosen couldn't fit in his system. Heck, Cliff Kingsbury was a pocket passer in an air raid. It's not like he can't construct an offense around Josh Rosen to make it work.
Yep.
I just think with where that roster is at on offense, Kyler Murray can probably make you a better team sooner because of his athleticism and his ability to create some things where Josh Rosen's a good athlete.
Mm-hmm.
He's probably actually a better athlete than what Dwayne Haskins is.
Yep.
If you talk about movement and
sure.
run and all that. But at the end of the day, I'm still not sure it's enough to really allow him to be able to win right away. I think Kyler Murray can maybe get you a win or two more just because of that mobility.
I mean, Josh Rosen got killed last year, and their offensive line isn't going to just – I mean, it's not going to be one of the best offensive lines overnight.
It was decimated by injury. That was
right.
part of it.
They'll
be healthy.
Better for whoever it is, but I totally agree with you. That's the one thing that Kyler Murray does bring to you. The other thing he gives to you, too, is he takes away – you know, as an offensive coordinator, you're trying to call up plays that work, right?
Right.
They don't all work. Like, sometimes they're just covered. I think that's the one thing that – makes some of these guys attractive that can run around, they can get you out of a bad play.
Right.
It's not a check. It's them scrambling around and making things happen. And I think Kyler Murray can do that. And that'll get you some wins on a bad team. Like that can help it's not going to make you a playoff team, but it'll prevent you from being 2-14.
Well, yeah. And he's got all the ability to throw the football down the field, whether it's vertically or
right.
even with timing and anticipation. He's demonstrated all that. I think the point you bring up is most interesting because if you talk to NFL coaches and you ask them, what's the most difficult position to develop right now in the NFL? They'll say it's offensive linemen.
Yep.
We don't hit as much. These guys coming in now come from playing in 2-point stances in college football and they're usually going backwards or laterally. They're not ever driving out and run blocking and they're not ever in 3-point stance. It takes longer to get those guys in. I was talking with a coach last night. He said, you draft offensive linemen for the next year. A la the New England Patriots.
Yep.
They have Trent Brown, plays great for you. They let him go in the free agency. Isaiah Wynn steps in now, their first round pick from a year ago that we kind of forget about, partly because he's got a little bit injured, but still. So that's, when you've got that big of a discrepancy with the ability to develop offensive linemen And then the ability to affix it when you don't have a great offensive line, you then have to have a more mobile quarterback. That's where this league is going right now because of the way the offseason rules has been. And I think also a product of what we're seeing at the high school and college systems with the type of offense is being run.
Are you in on Josh Rosen? Like, if you were a team, would you be calling to trade for him?
Now, if I was the Giants and I could get him for a second round pick, yes.
So is that more of a value play because you think you can get a first rounder at a second round value, or is that you think he could be the future of your franchise?
It's both. I think he could be the future. I think he's smart. I think he, when you watch him and just his, first off, he's not scared.
Right.
That guy was thrown in as tight of windows as anyone last year as a rookie. He's young. He's mobile enough to be able to make it work. And I just think you put him in a system with Saquon Barkley to give him some help. They've got Ingram as well, a tight end, and Sterling Shepard, and they'll figure out someone else to come in and help out. I think he would be able to distribute the football well enough. And I do think he could potentially, you know, be a guy that's the future franchise quarterback. Like, I'm not giving up on him just based on how last year looked in Arizona.
The thing that makes me nervous about him has nothing to do with his football talent. It's all the intangibles, leadership styles. Like you said, he's smart. I think he's a smart Alec. We'll go with that. I think he's a little bit of a punk still, and I don't know if he grows out of that. But I think it's pretty telling that the Arizona Cardinals are even considering this because they've had him for a year.
Right.
And not Cliff, but, you know, the people there, Condo, the general manager, like, they've seen him. They know what he's like every day. They know what his teammates feel about him. And if they're willing to move on from a first round pick for Kyler Murray, who's great, is good, but I don't think he's generational. I don't think it's like you're going for Andrew Luck or when the Broncos moved on from Tim Tebow because it was Peyton Manning. Like, that made it a no-brainer decision.
Right.
I don't think it's one of those no-brainers. I think it tells me something about Josh Rosen. And it's not – like, I agree with you. Take last year and throw it out the window. I think he was the best, most natural thrower of the football of that class last year. Yeah. But there was just something about him that I don't like, and it scares me.
I don't know, though, that this pick is going to be Steve Kimes again. Part of me feels like it's Michael Bidwell's. And, you know, if you're making a decision with Cliff and you're making a decision to draft the number one overall pick – the owner's probably getting involved. And that's where I think it's a little bit different in this case, not devaluing Josh Rosen, but saying they're going in a different direction that maybe includes who they have a quarterback.
For sure. Baker Mayfield has been, was a guy who had an incredible rookie year last year. It was awesome. Was off the charts. Now he's got more weapons to work with.
Yeah.
I loved it when they traded for Odell Beckham. I was sitting there saying, oh, Browns in the Super Bowl. What I don't like, a lot of people love it, and that always makes me nervous. Like, when everybody's in on this bandwagon, and they are the trendy pick right now, people are saying they're going to turn it around. There's not always, but a lot of times you'll see a sophomore slump. You'll see guys who were incredible. Dak Prescott was, you know, a perfect example. Rookie year, lights it up. Him and Zeke go off, and then he kind of comes back to reality. I don't think that's the case with Baker Mayfield. I think he's a great thrower of the football. I think he's got the intangibles. I think his teammates love him. I don't think he plays a style where teams figure him out because he's not a scrambler. I think he can play from within the pocket. So I think his trend continues up.
I think it can. It should, because of the talent he has on this roster now. It should. I mean, you put any quarterback on this team, they should be able to put up some numbers. And there's a few things working in you know, besides the talent that he has on the roster, there's a few things working in his direction. Todd Monken, who's their OC. Forget about retaining Freddie Kitchens. Todd Monken's one of the better offensive minds. You saw that historic streak that the Tampa Bay Bucs were on with Ryan Fitzpatrick to start off with last season. Todd Monken's calling the plays. So they're not going to be scared. This team's going to be attacking teams vertically down the field. There's going to be continuity in the offense, so it's not like Baker's going to have to worry too much about the terminology, and you know how difficult that is.
Yeah.
My concern is this. The offensive line, for the reasons we just talked about, and he is good enough to move in the pocket to throw and athletic enough to do all that, but he needs some help on the offensive line. They have to be able to continue to build there so he has the protection. And it's not like the Pittsburgh Steelers and the Baltimore Ravens and the Cincinnati Bengals are going to lay down and give him that division. I think the hardest step to take in the NFL is being able to be that 7-8-1 team and then be able to win 10 games. You can go 10-6 and win the division. I've said that before. That's what it took for Baltimore to win it this year. I think it's tough to do. Yeah. Like, we were 10-6 my rookie year. We brought in Sean Rogers on the D-line, Corey Williams. All of a sudden, we had all these pieces. You know, Dante Stallworth to go next to Braylon Edwards and Kel Winslow and everyone else. We had all these pieces. And then it just, we had injuries. We had a lot of other stuff go on that didn't allow us to be able to replicate that. That's the tough part of the NFL. It's built for parity. And so we'll see how they handle that. And we'll see how they handle some adversity. Because you and I both know this.
Yep.
They're going to hit some adversity. What happens if they start off 2-4? is Odell Beckham and Jarvis Landry going to be able to be, you know, get along? Is it going to be copacetic, or are they going to all of a sudden, you know, show their true colors? These are guys who came from Miami and came from New York. Like, when life isn't good in Miami and New York, you have other avenues. When it's not as good in Cleveland, like, it's not very good.
Right. And last year, this was a darling. Everybody loved him. Cleveland Browns fan loved him because they shocked the world. They had this big turnaround, almost made the playoffs. This year, the expectation is you will make the playoffs. And so what if they're falling short of that? How does that work out? Totally agree with you on that one. All right. All right. Welcome back to Kinnell and Bell. Early to start off the show, we talked about Florida State getting waxed by Gonzaga. We talked about the Purdue-Tennessee game, which was probably one of the most entertaining games of the tournament. The other game that was thoroughly entertaining was Duke versus UCF this past Sunday, which was an incredible finish. UCF was this close, two shots rimmed in and out.
Should have won.
And they had that opportunity to win too. A couple, you know, controversial calls with the officials. That's the other thing too. When we were talking about replay early in the show, even with replay, we still get stuff that people don't see the same page. You know, like in Duke's play, yeah, when they had the ball hit the basket and it was, did it hit the rim or did it not? I clearly thought it did not hit the rim.
I thought it was pretty easy to see too, but.
But there were some people that said, no, I've talked to like friends of mine who are like, no, it definitely touched the, grazed the rim. I'm like, no, it didn't. But that's the thing about replay.
It would have just changed the spin of the ball, which it didn't.
Right.
And that's, again.
Exactly. Which, you know, whatever.
Which so makes that, it not indisputable. And that's.
Right. That's always their bailout too, is the indisputable evidence though. But Duke in that game, a lot of people are saying, they're susceptible now. Maybe UCF showed a game plan by, you know, kind of packing it in, let Duke shoot from the three-point line, where they're one of the – I think they are the worst three-point shooting team in the tournament, one of the worst in the country.
They're the worst one seed coming into it, I believe, ever.
Yeah, as far as shooting the three-pointer. But they're still – they still have three, you know, lottery picks for the NBA draft. They still have the most exciting explosive player in the country in Zion Williamson. And a lot of people might say R.J. Barrett is better than Zion. I don't think they're going to get beat by Virginia Tech, even with familiarity that Virginia Tech's had against playing against them in the ACC. I just think – I almost feel like Duke, there were a couple things that kind of woke them up. It was the – you know, getting Zion, losing him, going 3-for-3, getting him back. But then it was also losing to Carolina the first time when – and it was the last game of the season, I think, when they lost the regular season.
Regular season.
I thought, like, sometimes there can be good losses. I think it's a perfect time for Coach K to come in and coach them hard and say, hey, you guys think you're good, but you need to do this. I feel like this is not the matchup where they're doing it, because I think they're going to be just simply a lot better than Virginia Tech.
Big difference between what UCF presented and then what Virginia Tech will present. There's no Taco Fall.
Right.
I mean, like, yeah, there's no 7'6" dude who's going to guard the rim.
He was fun to watch, man. I hadn't watched him a lot. It was freakish. Like,
he was a difference maker. To your point, it really forced Duke to play from the perimeter. And so unless Virginia Tech packs it in, which they can choose to do, I still think Zion, RJ Barrett, Cam Reddish, I still think those guys would be attacking the rim in that scenario. I just don't think Virginia Tech has the same type of personnel to be able to do what UCF did. And plus, that game plan's already out there. You don't think Coach K went back and looked at what UCF did and said, these are the things that teams are going to say we can't, you know, handle or can't counter. We've got to continue to come up with a game plan for it. So I think they're going to be able to adjust as well.
Oh, it was crazy. Taco Fall, like, seeing him, how much he affected shots, even if he wasn't there, it's just you could tell that Duke players, when they were driving or anywhere near the lane, like, they were alternating their arc because they were like, they do a lot of times, but even when he doesn't, it's like his presence would get in their head a little bit.
That bothered me though, because the whole time, like, anytime, and I don't know how this was, I mean, I remember when you're young, and you know how you usually have a couple of those guys who, like, just grow up before everyone else? They've got
that
your
was man.
They have your Fu Manchu in seventh
grade.
That was
not me. I was just tall.
And you're sitting there, you're like,
what do we do?
I don't have anybody here. Right. And the first thing that our coach would always teach us is, you just drive right at him every time. And you try to get him fouled out as soon as possible. Taco Fall had foul trouble a little bit in the first half. I was shocked that they didn't try to get him out sooner in that game, because once he was out, it just seemed like it was an entirely different dimension for Duke in scoring, and then it opened everything up. And I think that's probably going to be similar to what we see versus Virginia Tech.
Are you in on Zion, like, all in? I am all in. I think he's going to be the next torchbearer for the NBA. Like, I think he's going to be the next superstar, the next LeBron. Like, I feel like it went, you know, from MJ to Kobe to LeBron to maybe Kevin Durant, and then it'll be Zion. Like, he's the next thing in the NBA. I think production-wise, scoring-wise, superstardom, I think he is. But some of our wonderful guys here on the show totally disagree. They're like, he's not even going to average 14. 14 is where we've set his rookie points per game.
Yeah.
I think he'll go over that easily. And they're like, nah, he's going to be okay. He'll be a good pro. I think he's going to be a star.
I think he's going to be a star because of what he has already done in college. I'm not all in on the production and what it will be at the next level yet. Like, do I think he'll average 14 his rookie year? Yeah, I do. Because I think the team, one that drafts him, is going to be pretty bad, and he's going to get plenty of opportunities, at least from a scoring perspective. So I think he's going to be able to hit those numbers. But long-term, what he can develop into, he's going to have to continue to improve his perimeter shooting. Bottom line, you know, we talked about how bad they've been at three-point shooting coming into the tournament and even, you know, a couple of instances in the tournament. But that's not going to change from going to the NBA. It's only going to get worse, and teams are only going to force him to do that more. So there are a lot of things I love about his game, his personality, how he handles interviews and just talking. He seems like a humble guy who, you know, look, he came back because he wants to win a national championship. Like, that in itself, he could have, after the whole shoe exploded.
Yep. Could have sat out.
He could have sat out. He could have just said, I don't want to do this. And he decided to come back because he wants to try to win a national championship, be with his teammates. And there's something to be said about that.
You know what drives me nuts when I'm watching a lot of these press conferences with Zion is the media, and most of them have an agenda that they want to pay the players. They're exploited, right, all this. They keep just floating the bait out there. They're asking him, begging him to say something like, yeah, I'm getting hosed, or I should be making money. Every single time he's gone back to, I just want to play ball with my teammates. I came to Duke to win a championship. I'll get paid when I want. Like, he has not taken any shot at the system, and I commend him for that.
I don't know if we talked about this or not, but one of the things that I thought was interesting with the NBA talked about getting rid of the one and done.
Yep.
If you look at the NFL draft now, it's a legitimate must-see TV. It's on broadcast networks now. And one of the reasons is these players coming from college, they become household names. They're part of big brands that they're attached to with these huge fan bases, and then they end up watching their journey going to the NFL. If you would have had Zion Williamson coming out of high school, he wouldn't have had the same following. Now, granted, there's a social media platform out there that everyone's going to see him on the highlights and the dunks and all that, but now he's got the brand of Duke behind him. And I think that sells better for the NBA and the draft when it comes out to it. Like, I think getting rid of the one and done, it's more for the players than it is for the actual NBA, which is why I'm surprised that Silver would even think about doing that. Because now I want to see where Zion goes.
Yeah.
Like, I can't wait to see which team's going to have the chance to take him. I want to see where RJ Barrett goes. I want to see where John Morant goes. Like, I want to see where all these guys go. If they just left from high school, we would have never had the opportunity to really get to see them, especially in March Madness, especially in this moment.
There's no question that Zion, had he been able to be a one and done, he would have been a millionaire, right? He would have gotten a shoe deal. He would have been drafted.
Probably not as big of a shoe deal, though.
Well, that's the thing. I think he's probably increased his potential earnings by 10 times just from playing at Duke.
Can we be honest, too? The shoe blowing up probably actually was good for him.
Oh, for sure.
It's leveraged now.
Yeah, Nike can't let him go now. So they're going to back up the truck.
Adidas is going to be pitching that to him the whole time.
As opposed to him getting like 20 or 30 million, I bet he gets 100 million from Nike now. Because we'll have to see how that goes. Let's move over to the NFL, because the NFL has seen potentially a shift in power going more to the players. Potentially. And I think it's interesting, because I've always believed, you tell me if you think you agree with this, I think NFL players are jealous of NBA players and Major League Baseball players. Guaranteed contracts, more money. When you look at the NBA, they're bigger stars. They have more name recognition, more cachet. And so I feel like players have always wanted to try to have that type of influence. And I think Antonio Brown did change the game somewhat, but because he was able to force his way out of a situation where he wasn't happy. But I think what needs to happen is players need to be really, really careful, because he's a top three wide receiver in the league. And it just so happened to work out where he was sent somewhere nice that he wanted to go to the Raiders. Because I feel like he was this close to going to Buffalo, and then he would have been sitting in the same contract in another team that he wouldn't have, didn't want to be on. And it could have gone south really quickly. So I think there is a shift in mindset of players being more open to, hey, I'm going to hold out, I'm going to sit out a season. But I think they need to be really careful doing it.
I think they need to be smarter about how they construct their contracts.
Yes.
You know, for some of these agents, you know, they pitch you on the total value of the contract.
Yep.
That is not the commitment that these teams are making these players. Just look at what's guaranteed at signing. What's guaranteed at signing, and then they'll have some injury guarantees as well that extend, that create your total guarantees. That's the commitment that the team actually has. So you're right. In order for them to want to be like the NBA players or Major League Baseball players, it's going to take a while. I mean, let's be honest. The salary cap has to go up. Everything has to go up. It's going to be a while before they can get there. They're going to have to sign shorter deals that are going to be fully guaranteed, like what Kirk Cousins did.
I'm glad you brought it up, because my affinity for Kirk Cousins is often mocked on this show. He did it perfectly.
He did.
because he made a lot of money with the franchise tags back to back, and then
he broke the bank.
Yeah, and then he broke the bank with the $84 million deal. And guess what? It's only a 3-year deal.
Right.
So and he's and you know, you can say whatever you want about how it was.
If he continues,
he's a top 10 passer every single year of his career. If he just continues the pace, maybe it's not the Vikings. There will be another
someone else
that'll pay him. And in the end, he's going to get just as much as he would have one of these phony deals that would have said 120 or whatever it is. The guaranteed amount probably would have been less than the 84. Probably would have been
after
75. You know?
After this next season, if he puts up the same stats, which he was like, what, 30 touchdowns, 10 interceptions, 4,000 yards?
Yeah.
Someone's going to want that. They're going to start negotiating again for an extension. And if not, you know, they can let him go play out his final year. He's still making bank, and they can franchise tag him if they want to go that route with him. He'll gladly accept that.
Right.
Or he can go into free agency.
And by the way, that $84 million, fully guaranteed. That's, and so that's the misperception about NFL contracts is there's nothing prohibits you from doing it. You have to have the leverage to do it and a team that'll do it. I actually think it's maybe you leave some longer term money on the table, but you're probably going to be set for life, financially. And in most cases, there aren't that many significant injuries anymore, knock on wood, like Alex Smith, like that's a tragic, but for the most part, if you have an ACL, you'll be back. You can get back. Like, you're not going to lose that much.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And as it relates to Antonio Brown though, right, you have to have thick skin because what he did, not a lot of guys can handle. So forget about him being a top three wide receiver. You also have to be able to handle the fact that people on social media and everyone else out there in the media, they're probably going to be saying to you, like, this guy looks crazy. He looks unhinged. Who wants that on their team? You have to endure that for a little bit before you then go get traded, sign a new deal, and now you come into that press conference clean shaven, looking good, ready for your next opportunity.
Yep, no doubt about it. All right, welcome back to Canel and Bell, finishing up on a Friday. The New England Patriots, they've had to deal with a lot recently. So they're used to losing a lot of coaches, right? Yeah. I mean, Brian Flores leaves, you know, they're always coaches from the, you know, the Patriots that are always going to leave. Gronk retires. I don't think that caught him that by surprise though. I mean, last year he was speculated that he might retire. But this latest news, I think, is a little bit concerning. Greg Schiano, who was hired to be their defensive coordinator, just out of nowhere, it was kind of a bombshell for the NFL, stepped down, and he cited a need to spend more time on my faith and family. He actually had never been the hire. It had never been officially announced by the club, which is just the Patriot way. They don't do it. It's a surprise, but I guess when you think that Belichick is probably the defensive coordinator anyway, it doesn't have that much of an impact. But I do feel like the Patriots are probably one of the hardest, harshest off seasons they've had as far as dealing with things that actually matter. Not rifts between a trainer and Brady, but like meaningful personnel moves that are gone now.
Yeah. I mean, I look at it this way. So for Greg Schiano, I think the hard thing is, you know, what opportunities the rest, because he's still relatively young, you know, what opportunities is he going to have for the rest of his career in regards to coaching? I mean, this is a guy who had a ton of success with Rutgers, put them on the map. Didn't so much with the Tampa Bay Bucks, and then kind of fell out of favor. And then there was the whole, you know, did he get the Tennessee, you know, head coaching job before that got tanked? And so this was an opportunity where you thought, okay, he's going to go to the NFL. Maybe at some point then he'll be cycled back around. He'll have a chance, but, to not, whatever's going on in his life, that's obviously most important to him. But you just wonder long term for his career, what this is going to end up meaning. And you also wonder if there's something else out there, and you hate to speculate, but, you know, the whole Zach Smith saga at Ohio State, that all of a sudden is going to be coming, you know, more public or back into the public's eye because he's starting bringing out a podcast. You wonder if that's a part of it. But for the Patriots, you know, because it's not necessarily Bill Belichick calls the defense, but he definitely knows what he wants. And so that's why it's not as concerning. I think he has as good of a feel for what they want to do, what personnel they're looking for, how they're evaluating that personnel as anyone. So it's not easy. You can just take a guy out, plug them back in, and we're going to see that result. I think we saw with the transition coordinators over the years, sometimes, at least defensively speaking, there's a little bit of a lapse or a slow period where it takes them about half a season to figure out what they're good at, and then they start rolling in the second half of the season. That's usually how the New England Patriots end up going about, you know, playing defense from the transition from, you know, whoever before Patricia, you know, to Brian Flores, now Brian Flores to the next guy. It's usually what we see.
I don't think it'll be that much of a loss for them. I think Gronk hurting is a huge loss production-wise from what he means to that team. Even if he wasn't that healthy, just the threat of him game planning defensive schemes, you know, like the way they do that. I think this one's probably pretty minimal. They haven't done that much. They don't even have their rookies in, you know, in place right. yet. I mean, they're probably just starting minicamp. So they're not, I don't think it's going to be that big of a deal, but I do think it's going to be interesting.
The last thing that I do believe though, the culmination of Brady being 42, Gronk being retired, if he stays retired, you know, losing a guy like Trey Flowers, not, you know, and having you settled in on who your defensive coordinator is, you know, those are issues that they've dealt with in the past, but hasn't impacted them quite as much. The difference to me is this now. Look, the Jets have their franchise quarterback, Sam Darnold. Yes, a new coach, but I think they're going to be a little bit better.
Yeah.
The Bills, I think they're going to be a little bit better. They have their franchise quarterback in Josh Allen. They're trying to improve that roster. You know, the Dolphins are in a state of flux. They probably have the worst roster right now in the NFL. And so they're in a transition, but that's the other thing is like maybe the Bills and Jets will be a little bit more competitive, but either way, I think if we're looking at the NFL as a whole, the AFC East, the Patriots still have it easier than anyone else in winning that division again this year.
When you were a kid, did you ever break dance?
No. I was never. Not a good enough dancer to be.
Really? You never tried alone in your room to kind of work a move or two?
I don't know about alone in my room. I'm sure at some point I looked and was like, what was that?
I remember I had to bring something to the eighth grade dance, so I did a little robot when you go,
Is that considered breakdancing?
Yeah,
that was actually pretty good.
That's the origination.
That was actually pretty good.
And our producer who's dealing with injuries right now didn't even get it on tape with the shot right there because it was actually really good. It kind of pop and lock right there. Janita knows what I'm talking about. But they're actually, breakdancing is actually, could potentially be an Olympic sport in 2024. I mean, what are we doing here?
What are the Olympics anymore?
I don't know because you're getting away from sports that actually are. And like, you know, it was one thing when you try to get, you know, skateboarding and snowboarding and some of the winter games in there, which I get. Those are becoming more mainstream, but breakdancing, like this is what we're doing right now.
I would think, and I don't even know how long the Olympics have been around, right? Long time though. I would imagine that past Olympians, like you go back 100,
right.
They would be shocked to see. They'd be like, what is this?
Right.
Why are they having a party? Why are they giving it?
Because being an Olympian, your wife knows really well, is something that's probably the most, it's like one of the coolest accomplishments.
Without a doubt.
There's like a prestige about it. And if they open it up to this, it does make it look a little bit corny. During the Winter Olympics every year, I get frustrated because I'm like, man, I should try to do a Winter Olympic sport. I said it one time that I thought I could be an Olympic curler. And I actually, there was a guy listening to the radio show I was on that was an Olympic curl and he got really offended. He was like, oh, you guys are just downplaying this.
It's harder than you think, right?
Yeah. He was like, oh, it's harder than you think. Jared Allen from the former NFL star is actually training to try to be an Olympian in curling. And I have never been a bigger fan of Jared Allen than I am now because the dude wrote an article like to the curling association complaining that it was diminishing their accomplishments in the sport. I so badly want Jared Allen to go to the Olympics as a curler.
So I was
fond of that.
I was following this. They got close. I don't think they quite like qualified.
They didn't make it.
There's other groups who are like much better. I think they do. I think they do. But that's the one sport and then bobsled. That's the other one where they kind of like.
Right. I had a buddy of mine that actually really seriously was trying to recruit me to go do it with him. And he's like a trainer. He's a guy that was training with me. And he was like, you know, he was like, we could do this.
Now we got breakdancing.
Let's go. We could do either one.
It's going to take
a few years. Already saw my bop and lock. Boom.
That's
all right.
Good.
Have a good weekend.
That's pretty good.